I'm Norman Gray. You are A345, as we have just fairly conclusively established. We're all back to face-to-face teaching. Yay! It's been a very hard couple of years. And I think some of you will... None of you are third years, is that right? You're all fourth and fifth years? Right, so all of you will have had at least 1 year at university, but your second and third years may have been a bit complicated. But well done for making it through. Some of you, I think I may have taught special relativity to in A2 2 years ago. Yep, I'm seeing some nods. Good, good, good. Then you are... some of the diagrams you will be familiar to. Okay, without too much further ado, before I talk about that, what I do want to do is mention, as Professor Kontar did, the Moodle and a couple of things that are on the relevant page. So, we go there. No, I haven't forgotten my password. Right. That's from 345. Cycle B. I want to draw attention to a couple of things. First is there's a folder of lecture notes there, which contains lecture notes. I'll have a little more to say about these in a moment, so I'll come back to that very shortly. I also want to draw attention, however, to Padlet. And Padlet is either to show them to describe, it's various bits of fragments of questions. If you have a question, double click on that, ask a question, but have a bit of extra context. It's all anonymous, I have no idea who's asking questions. I will sporadically but not entirely reliably check that and try and update the questions that are there. Or just ask me. This is for the shy. And for those who think they have a slightly complicated question that they want to work out how to get down. So all modes of asking questions are good. There is also a Microsoft Stream channel. Unlike previous years, that's not a core part of the whole thing. But there will be one or two things there. I do have, from previous years, some brief five-minute videos acting as overviews of the various parts. And I will post them there. I think they're quite useful just... To be useful to let you get an overall impression of what the upcoming part is going to be. So I will post them there. But that's not going to be a big deal for this year. Okay, let's move away from Moodle, get back to the slides. I don't have a big thing about slides because, other web pages, I'll mention A2SR. I think you should be able to see that my A2 special relativity lecture notes, you might enjoy those. If you want to see those and you can't see them, then let me know. Now, before I get onto this, I'll say that the way I've developed of teaching this and, as it turns out, the SR, is fairly specific. I do put the lecture notes, which are quite a lot of text, up beforehand. And what I want you to do is look at those beforehand. Not read them through and digest and fully understand, but look at them to get an impression of what's coming up. So the lecture isn't a surprise. The notes there are spoiler alerts all the way through. You know, they're there for you to not be surprised when I start talking about something, right? The lecture is the main event. That's me explaining it to you. I will often elide details. I'll say the details are in the notes, or read about this here, or read about this in this book. I'll aim to communicate the main idea in the lecture, but I won't always fill in the details. Because after the lecture, you'll be able to go back to the notes and go, now I see the point. It will be possible, I think, to just go to the lectures and ignore the notes and pass. It'd be possible, I think, to ignore the lectures and just read the notes and pass, but it'd be harder in both cases. The expectation, the plan, is that the two can complement each other. There's not a huge amount of stuff to learn in this course. It's just what there is quite hard. And it's a case of understanding rather than accumulation of knowledge. And that means a couple of things. It means you do have to think. It means you do have to assemble an understanding from the various resources that are available. And it also means you can't cram it all at the end. That really doesn't work. I mean, with some courses, you know, okay, don't do that, but you know, you can sort of get away with it. In this one, part two builds on part one, part three builds on part two, part four absolutely builds on part three. So if you're not, you know, getting some sort of idea of what's going on, it will get progressively harder. Okay. I do record the lectures, audio. However, that's dependent on batteries and me not accidentally turning the recording off and stuff. So don't depend on that. I'll put those up once I sort out a couple of technicalities. But so they're there as a sort of revision aid rather than as something you should depend on. Okay. I'm getting going with the actual relativity in a moment. But the last thing I want to mention in a sort of pedagogical sense is that although it's a couple of pedagogical fashions out of date, I do like aims and objectives. And the distinction to them between them is clear to me. In the aims are the point of the course. They're the things that, the why you're doing this course, the why I'm teaching it, they're the things you'll remember after the course is finished, you know, in years to come. And there are things like appreciate, understand, quite general things, quite high level things. The problem, that's the point, that's why you're doing this, the aims. The problem with that is it's easy to say, oh yes, I understand that, I appreciate that, but you can't do an exam in appreciation. So, what there are also companions to them, not a one-to-one relation, but companions, objectives. And these are the party tricks. These are the things that you can do. They are explain. There are things you can do. Which are the sort of things you can do in an exam? So when I write the exam, I have the list of objectives in front of me. And the exam is basically conformant or consistent with those objectives. Not in a sort of precise one-to-one thing, but if something is clearly not covered in the objectives, then I think that's out of scope for the exam. If it's broadly mentioned, you know, alluded to in the objectives, then that's in there, possibly. Okay? So that's the distinction for me. So these are not exciting things, but are things you can do. And the exercises that are attached to the base parts are keyed fairly precisely to these objectives. Okay. I think I'm about to start talking about relativity now, so the administrative and pedagogical things are over. Are there any questions about where we've got to so far? Any questions, anxieties, worries, neuroses, or other dislocations, psychological dislocations of that type? None that anyone's prepared to admit to. Okay, that's not necessarily good. I mean, I like questions because questions are good because they help me understand if I'm going too quickly or too slowly. So I like questions. Okay. Still nothing. Okay. Well, that's good. That's good. That's good. Right. You've seen this before. This is Newton's second law. Force is proportional to the rate of change of momentum. You're all familiar with that. That's not wrong. We have more to say about that, but that's good. I did have the other one. I thought I had another version of that. The key thing about this, from our point of view, is that it's a vector relation. It says that the force vector is proportional to the rate of change of the momentum vector. And you say, well, yeah, that's not really a big deal. It is a big deal, because that is a geometrical statement. It's saying these things have a magnitude and a direction, and that side is proportional to that. We're not talking about coordinates. We're not talking about numbers here. Just saying that's proportional to that is a physical statement. You know, you can imagine a world but that's not true. A science fiction world, but that's not true. But in this universe, that's true. And that's a very big deal. And it's true whatever the coordinates are that you pick, I mean, in most cases, you'll solve that by using, you know, Cartesian coordinates. It might be that there's a case where you solve that using, you know, spherical polar coordinates. And the maths will look very different in each of those cases, possibly very hellishly complicated in one of those cases. But the basic geometrical statement is the same in both. And that's what we're holding on to all the way through this course. And indeed, that is the principle, that statement is the principle of general covariance, which is a grand way of saying what I've just said, which is that all physical laws must be invariant under coordinate transformations. All physical laws must look the same or be the same independent of the coordinates you choose to describe them. So it doesn't matter if I choose Cartesian coordinates to work out the consequences of f equals dp by dt or use spherical polars. They're just numbers. That's just maths. The physical laws must be independent of the choice of coordinates. And you think, and that doesn't sound like a big deal. I mean, you think, well, that's certainly convenient. That's certainly nice. I mean, that's certainly been my experience in the physics I've learned in the past. But it's not just a nice thing. It turns out to be massively important, and Einstein based the whole of GR on that. That's where all of GR comes from, that statement. The principle of general covariance. The demand that that be true is where everything else falls out from. And the principle of relativity here, am I saying anything that I've forgotten to say here? And we can combine that with the principle of relativity, which is that's not, I mean, I illustrated that with F equals dp by dt, Newton's, basically a combination of Newton's first and second laws. It's not just true of mathematics, or of mechanics, it's true of all physics. So Einstein here is saying, you know, the principle of covariance applies to all of physics, not just mechanics. We'll talk about mechanics most of the time, because it's, you know, straightforward to talk about, and we can all understand that very well, but it applies to all of physics. And although the equivalently, but not obviously identical, it is equivalent, but the link between them is not trivial. No experiment performed wholly within one local inertial frame can detect its motion relative to any other local inertial frame. Now, the words local, inertial, and frame are all important there. A frame is just a coordinate frame. It's just a coordinate system. It's an X, Y, and Z. It's very low. A frame is just a coordinate system. It's a choice of where your origin is and where the axes are. Inertial, from your recollection of special relativity, you will remember what inertial means. It's something where Newton's laws work, basically. We'll have more to say about what that is. We'll complicate that a little bit in a moment. But that's basically the same idea, or most of the same idea, as you know from special relativity. And local is important, because what we're talking about here is the local part of an inertial frame. We're not talking about things that are far away from us. Because that will become more important later on. But the word local is meant to mean within a short distance of here. Now, what is short? I mean, short, depending on the experiment you're doing, depending on the measurement you're doing, short could be a meter or it could be a parsec. But the point is, it's not infinite. And it also means short in terms of time. It could be 10 seconds or it could be years. Or millennia, whatever. So the point is, it's a bounded, there's a bounded box within which your which is your local inertial, the local part of your inertial frame. And this says, in that, you can't tell which of those of the various possible inertial frames you're in. That is equivalent to the thing you might remember from special relativity. You can't tell if you're moving, but this is more profound than that. Are there any questions at that point? Another thing that is unexpected here, which I'm just going to drop in here, but leave slightly hanging. Oh, no, I'm not going to leave hanging, but we're going to pick up again, which seems to be unrelated to the two statements I've just made, is the strange business of inertial and gravitational masses. Now, Newton's law of gravitation, that's F equals G, big G mm over R squared, says that the gravitational force between two objects is proportional to the gravitational mass of those objects. What's the gravitational mass? That's the amount of gravitational charge, you like. That's the amount of stuff that the gravitational field acts on. Okay? So that's it's how coupled to, basically how coupled to the gravitational field is this mass. And the gravitational force is proportional to that. The acceleration is proportional, inverse proportional to the mass, the inertial mass. So if you push something, then how much it accelerates is a function of how inertial it is. A heavier thing, a thing with more inertial mass, will resist the pushing more and accelerate less. And that inertial mass is that. It's the amount of resistance to being pushed. Nothing to do with gravity. It's resistance. But, and Galileo's contribution to physics was essentially working, discovering that. And Newton tied that down mathematically in his second laws. But Galileo, this business of dropping things over the Leaning Tower of Pisa, showed, this isn't what he thought he was showing, but what he did show was that this gravitational mass and this inertial mass are precisely proportional. So if you double the amount of resistance a mass has to being pushed, the only way of doing that also doubles the coupling to the gravitational force. Even though these two things have nothing to do with each other, as far as we can see. You know, you've never thought of that of them being distinct, but in fact they have nothing to do with each other. And yet, they are precisely proportional to each other. And this is why you've never heard of these terms, gravitational mass and inertial mass. I saw some of you looking so worried, am I supposed to know about inertial mass? No, you're not, because it's never been introduced before, because I introduced it here in order to remind you that the distinction doesn't matter. But there's no explanation for that in Newton's physics. That's a completely unexplained thing in Newton's physics. And I'm not sure, it's a question of the history of science, how much Newton was worried about that. I think there were some things. Newton didn't like the law of universal gravitation. He thought that can't be right. There were philosophical problems with it from his point of view. But I don't know if he was worried about that. But he should have been, because there's no explanation for that in Newton's physics. So that's a puzzle. How do we approach that? Imagine you are in a box, a spaceship, out in floating around somewhere very far away from gravitational masses. And in there, there's a bit of mechanical stuff, a watch, a bit of biological stuff, some other bits of energy, photons and so on. And they're all wandering around, they're all floating around. And because you're floating well away from gravitational masses, you're just floating around. And if you push it off the wall, you move in a straight line at constant speed until you hit the other wall. Newton's laws work, in other words. They really genuinely work. I mean, you push yourself off and you move in a straight line at constant speed until you hit something, and so on. So Newton's laws work there. Good. I mean, I trust no one's surprised at that. Okay? So you've got that picture. I'm not telling you anything new here. I'm just reminding you invite you to think of that picture and see if that makes sense. Now, we put a rocket under this. Not a very big rocket, but a small rocket. And we push the box. We don't push things in the box, we just push the box. So what happens? The people stay where they are, or the people and the clock and the pot plant stay where they are, but the box moves around them. And they don't, I mean, there's no air in this or anything, it's complicating. But the box will just move around them until they hit the ground, until they hit the bottom surface. And then they'll stay there, and they will accelerate at the same rate as the box does. That's not surprising. So, and if this rocket is designed to, with the right force, then it might accelerate this at 9.81 meters per second squared. And everyone inside will go, I can't tell, good heavens, am I on Earth or not? and they will be uncertain. I mean, I invite you to think what experiment you might do that would let you tell the difference between being in that situation and being on Earth. Can anyone think of what an experiment like that would be? How would you tell you were you were in this situation rather than being on Earth? The only one I can think of is having someone this side of the box, that side of the box, with very precise inclinometers. And if you're on Earth, then they would slightly point toward the centre of the Earth. And if they were in this situation, then they both point down. But that wouldn't be a local frame. Because the word local here, and we're talking about this as a local frame, the word local means it's small enough that you can't do that sort of stuff. That your experiments aren't precise enough to be able to detect that. So within the bounds of your experiments, that you can't do second order effects like that, I defy you to think of any way of telling the difference with that and being on Earth. And I'm confident you will not be able to come up with something, because it is a foundational principle of GR that you can't. That there is no difference between that and being on Earth. That the experience of being accelerated at a constant speed and the experience of being in our straight gravitational field are equivalent. Not just close, not just the same, but equivalent. They are the same thing, is what it's saying. Okay. And that's a physical statement. This is called the equivalence principle. Uniform gravitation. I will put these slides. I mean, there's nothing in these slides that isn't in the notes. These slides are just here, so I've got something to pace around in front of and talk about. I will put the slides up in the lecture notes folder, just because, why not? But I encourage you to write things down, because writing things down is engaging and putting things in the notes. The equivalence principle. Uniform gravitational fields. That's ones which are straight up and down, not ones which are pointing inwards, are equivalent to frames that accelerate uniformly relative to inertial frames. There's that word inertial happening again. What's an inertial frame? An inertial frame is one like that. It's one where Newton's laws work. Now, there are more elaborate ways of putting that, but in that frame, Newton's laws work. F equals ma precisely right. If you leave something, it stays where it is. If you push something, it moves at constant speed. So that's an inertial frame. That's your prototype inertial frame. And uniform gravitational fields are equivalent to ones that accelerate relative to that. So, where am I going with this next thing? So, open parenthesis. The principle of general covariance is, it restricts the it has physical content. It has physical and mathematical content. It's not just a bit of philosophy that we can think about and debate in the pub. It has consequences. It restricts the category of mathematical statements that we are prepared to countenance as portable descriptions of nature. So if you have a theory which violates the equivalence principle, it's wrong. You know, we don't have to think about it, it's just wrong. Because if the equivalence principle is true, then it supervenes on those. So it restricts what you can see. The relativity principle, as I just mentioned, picks out inertial frames as special. Those frames, you know, like the floating box, in which Newton's laws work, are special. They have a special status. And we'll carry on talking about them again and again and again. They are... there are things we can say about them that we can't say about other things. And the equivalence principle further constrains the set of these special frames by saying that those frames the acceleration business further constrains what the frames can be. I forget what I put. Why I've written that third thing, it's probably in the notes. Right. And so I'm going to, through this course, talk about things, certain things as physical statements. And what I mean by that A physical statement is a statement that picks out one possible universe from all the ones you can think of, mathematically or in some sort of dream state, and says, this one, of all the ones that are mathematically consistent, is ours. Other universes are possible. They're not this one. And so a physical statement is a statement that, that says the universe could be otherwise, logically, but it's not. And so when I say physical statement, that is that notion that I mean. There were plenty of mathematical statements in this. Mathematical statements just follow from what came before. And they can't be otherwise, or else logic is wrong. Physical statements could be otherwise. There's a contingency to physical statements, and there is, and that's where the physics is. So that's a good point at which to mention. Some of you will be doing maths. Some subset of you were doing maths, yes? Any of you doing maths? Oh, yeah, a few, yeah, okay. So this is a course in general relativity. It's a course which therefore also covers differential geometry. It's nonetheless a physics course, or an astrophysics course. It's not a maths course. And so we will be sloppy from the point of view of mathematicians, disgracefully so, but we don't care because we're physicists. Everything's being a physicist means the entire universe is analytic. That's what being a physicist means. Nonetheless, it is. I will mention just parenthetically to that, that it is quite a mathematical course. So hold on to your seats. So close parenthesis. How are we doing? I'm not doing too badly. Okay. Let's go back to this floating box. So what we're going to do now is talk about three thought experiments, three things that we, fantasy scenarios which we can analyse using what we've learned so far, and discover the physical content, the consequence of those statements. We're back to the box floating in space, and the observer floating in the middle of it. And we flash a light bulb on one side of the box, and we have a detector of some type, perhaps another observer, on the other side of the box. And given that this light is pointing across the box, then, you know, of course, it's going to go straight across the box and be detected the same distance down. No surprises there. There are no surprises there, okay? Now, let's do the same thing, but in a box which is falling. Now, that box is in free fall. I think that's the first time I've mentioned this, that phrase. I think there is a link there's a site link I've forgotten from the notes. Check the notes for the little bridging movement. The point here is that we are also taking things. That's it. Things which are moving only under gravity, like something which is floating out in away from all gravitating bodies. They are inertial frames. They are in free fall, so called, moving only under gravity, and they, we are saying, are also inertial frames. I'm sure there's a little bridging statement I've skipped here. That doesn't matter. So this falling box, imagine it's a lift and the cable's been cut. It's falling, in other words, moving purely under control of gravity, and so it's an inertial frame. And the equivalence principle says that situation there, with the box falling down the lift shaft and the people in it, is equivalent to being in the inertial frame well away from gravitating sources. Therefore, this person can't tell the difference between these two situations. They can't tell which inertial frame they're in. Therefore, when they see this light shone across the across the box, what they see is this. And so the light goes across and hits a little bit down from the top, as you'd expect. But from the point of view of someone standing by this, watching in horror as this lift shaft plummets to the ground, and hoping that this person is paying attention to their relative lectures and taking notes, hopefully very quickly, the light takes a finite time to cross. Not much, but a finite time to cross. And so the pit where it hits the other side will be slightly lower by the time the light gets there. Now, it must get there because the observer in the box, if it didn't get to that point, that expected point, which is the same distance down from the top, then this person would tell that something was amiss. So it does get to that point. But from this person's point of view, that point is lower than the starting point. In other words, the light has followed a curved path. And the only things we've used in that argument are the equivalence principle and the relativity principle. In other words, light is bent by gravity. It has no mass, but it's still bent by gravity. And that's strange. But that conclusion, I mean, which is true, but that conclusion comes only from the physics we've learned in the last half hour. I don't have time to work through this, but I have a few of these quick questions here. I will ask this question, just to establish this point. In a falling lift, I aim a spring gun, just not a light, not a relativistic spring gun, just an ordinary, you know, child's toy, across the lift, intended to hit the bulb. I want to hit the bulb, which is at B. Should I aim above the bulb? Should I aim directly at the bulb? Or should I aim below the bulb? Who would say A? Who would say B? Who would say C? Correct. Okay. You've all been paying excellent attention. Well done. This isn't just a story about light. It's a story about things falling, and you not being able to tell the difference. So there's no difference between this and doing the same thing with the weightless cabinet in orbit. Okay. Next. So you have a mass here, and you drop it. As it drops, it acquires kinetic energy from turns potential energy into kinetic energy, so it ends up down here with C is 1. Okay, just like in special relativity, we're using natural units. I'll have a little more to that in a moment. I'd better hurry up, or else we'll get to that bit. C is 1, so E is equal to M. Right, so the energy of this thing is equals mc squared. C is 1. The energy is there. When it gets down to here, the energy has gone up by the amount of potential energy loss in going down here. Okay, then we take this slightly more energetic mass and convert it into pure energy. That's kinematically impossible, but energetically perfectly reasonable. Okay, and we send that photon, the energy equivalent of that mass, back upwards until it gets to the top there. We start off with energy E and this energy E primed at the top there. Now, either we've invented a way of extracting free energy from the universe, or E is the same as M. So this must be a closed cycle. Okay? Or else we've got a perpetual motion machine. In other words, what that means is that the photon, which starts off with energy E here, which is bigger than M, ends up with energy E prime, which is the same as M. In other words, a photon climbing through a gravitational field loses energy. Simply because of, that's because of special relativity, an argument. Yes. So that's another thought experiment that says interesting physical things have to happen just because of what we've learned so far. And let's do that twice. So this is a setup called Shields Photons, because someone Shields used this example as part of some argument in the 50s, I think. So this is a Minkowski diagram. Z, the vertical direction, that way, and time in this direction. And we do the same thing as in the previous slide. We fire a photon upwards in the Z direction, and it loses energy. Okay. So it goes from frequency f, energy hf, to frequency f prime, energy f, e prime equals hf prime at the top. Okay, just like what we said before. Then we wait a bit. We wait n periods. And we do it again. Okay. So we do the exact same thing again. We send a photon of energy of frequency F up, and it arrives at the top at a different frequency, a lower frequency, because it's lost energy by climbing through a gravitational field. So that time difference is N over F, obviously, because we've waited that many periods. This time difference is also the same number of periods. But the frequency is different, so the period is different. So the time interval between B and B primed is not the time interval between A and A primed. You're entitled to be surprised at that. What that is telling you is that this isn't a parallelogram. The distance is the same in both cases, but the time distance on opposite sides of the parallelogram is not the same. In other words, this is not a Euclidean surface. It's not a Euclidean space. Now, it's a Minkowski space, so you didn't really expect it to be anyway, but the point here is that just with that gravitational redshift argument, you can just discover the first hint of that, and there'll be lots more of that. Okay, I think that's no other things to say. I have a quick question with that, which you can look at in the notes. Another one, so we don't have time to have votes. And this is also an important diagram, which we will see again in about 10 lectures. And it's two objects well up above the Earth. And they both fall down towards the centre of the Earth, directly towards the centre of the Earth. But this frame is big enough, there's not a local inertial frame, so the two balls will fall directly toward the centre of the Earth. Now, they're both in free fall. They're both in inertial frames locally. But if you ask, what's the separation between them? What's that xi distance? Then you discover that the second derivative of xi with respect to t is non-zero. So the second derivative of their position is non-zero. But they're not accelerating. So they are in free fall, so they are in non-accelerated frames, and yet the second derivative position is non-zero. What's happening here? What's happening here is that second derivative position is just a coordinate number. It's just a number, which is not the same as being pushed in the back and being accelerated. So I will aim to keep the distinction separate. When I mean acceleration, I mean push in the back. I mean something that you can detect locally and unequivocally and absolutely. There is a difference between that and a second derivative being different. And the reason why this happens, the reason why you can tell, why if you were these two people in radio contact with each other, you could say, oh, we appear not to be in a uniform gravitational field. It's because this frame is big enough that it's not local. So there's a tidal effect, so-called, happening here, which lets you detect that you're not, in this case, there isn't an inertial frame which covers both of these. Okay, this is an important slide because it's meant to be reassuring. So that's the end of the thought experiments. A few final remarks. That's the definition of differentiation that you are very familiar with because you learned about it in school. Okay. The derivative of f with respect to x is the limit of fx plus h minus f of x divided by h as you take that h to zero. You really understand that. We'll be doing the same. A large part of the mathematical structure of this course is learning how to do the same thing in a curved space-time. And the 10 lectures gets you to the point where you learn that mathematical apparatus that allows you to do that. GRG2, which comes in the next semester, is, okay, what follows from that in physical terms? So this first semester is basically learning how to do that in a curved space-time. And it's difficult because in this case, it's easy to know to think about what f of f at a different point is and how to subtract it. It needs to know what dividing by h means. In a curved space-time, both of those things are tricky. So we have to learn how to say the same thing. But it's the same thing happening. It's fundamentally the same thing happening. It's just, it will look hellish because the curvature does that for you. In terms of the overall structure, this part one, lecture one, almost done it, is setting the scene, saying why there's a problem, saying what the problem is. Part two is introducing tensors, mathematical structures that you might have stumbled across before, but have always seemed a little bit exotic and you don't necessarily have much to do with them. They are vital to an understanding of general relativity. Part three is learning how to differentiate those tensors, which is easier than one might think, but still not easy. And then part four is actually using all this mathematical apparatus to do what Einstein did and describe a theory of gravity in these terms. So today's been physics. The next seven lectures will be basically maths. The last three lectures are back to physics. So say bye-bye to physics for seven lectures. We will look forward to coming back, but that's what's happening. As a last thing, I'll mention natural units. I have lots more to say about natural units. Natural units are the units you choose when you say c is equal to 1. So you measure distance in meters and time in meters. A meter of time is the light meter. It's the time it takes for light to travel a meter. And in those units, in light meters, in meters per light meter, the speed of light is a nice, easy to remember 1. And I have notes in it. You will find stuff on the web about natural units, how they're terribly confusing. Oh my God, they're awful. But it's just a matter of picking the right units in which vectors of C disappear. And I think that's the last thing I've got to say. And I know you have to rush off to gallop around. You'll be so fit this semester, galloping around the campus trying to find things. I have a section in the notes about reading. There are many good books on relativity, on general relativity. This course is highly compatible with Schutz. Highly compatible in the sense, I'll even refer to it, they have the same overall set of ideas, so it's a good book to use. Carol is substantially different, and that's a good thing, because it's a nice contrast, it might suit you better. Rindler is very old-fashioned as far as the treatment of general relativity goes, but the first half of that book is really all about explanation of this, of subtleties and the equivalence principle. He distinguishes three different subversions of the equivalence principle. Rindler knows all about the physics of GR. Mrs. Thornwheeler, great big doorstop, wonderful book, which irritates the hell out of some people, but good. Some of these books are available at that URL, which is in the notes, which you can find at the library. There are electronic versions of some of these books, and you might be able to go wild. Okay, I think that's the end. It better be. Yes, it is. I will see you.